Good morning, Mr. Chair, Commissioners, Director Store. My name's Nate Pamplin. I'm the Policy Director with the department and joined this morning by...
And I'm Raquel Crozier. I'm your legislative liaison. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much for scheduling this workshop. This is, I think, the seventh or possibly eighth workshop since our operating budget was passed last June for this current biennium. And really, what we've been trying to do is make sure that you all have a real strong fundamental understanding, because we have some big decisions of you with adopting our formal requests for our operating and capital budgets, as well as for agency request legislation. So at these workshops, we've walked you through and lifted up the hood on the operating budget. We've provided you updates on the proviso and the various work products that we're tasked with developing. We've had workshops where we've asked for your engagement on how it is that you would like to be involved in this process and getting your understanding and kind of what the level do you want to be at the 30,000-foot level or kind of right at line item by line item. And so we've taken all that feedback today, and now we're at a spot where we're presenting to you some draft packages. In addition, and before we get started on that, the Commission adopted a blue sheet in February and asked us to provide you an overview of the state and federal legislative process. So Raquel and I will tag team on that. I'll remind you on the budget balancing decisions and kind of the overall context of the budget situation that we're in, and a quick orientation on the proviso. And then we'll spend quite a bit of time going through the actual operating budget requests and the agency request legislation. I think this will get at some of the concerns we heard earlier from Commissioner Holzmiller and Graybill on, boy, it feels like in just in August it's the first time you hear about this. That's what we're trying to eliminate, that concern. We've been at this for months, and now we're at a spot where we can really walk you through the details. And then ask that we close on some outreach. For this morning, I want to flag, here's four areas that this is a workshop and I'm going to ask for your engagement. The first is, do we have the right outcomes listed? Are these the right budget requests that meet your all's interests? Second, if we are going to pursue those, what's the fund source guidance? And what's about the overall funding target? I'll share with you some of the feedback that we've heard from our budget and policy advisory group. And then lastly, seek your guidance on how we shape up our agency request legislation and then take that out to the public. Here was the language from the blue sheet in February, and I'll turn it over to Raquel to walk through the budget process.
All right. So just briefly, I'm going to give you guys a little bit of background. I know you guys know this stuff, but just as a refresher, the state writes a budget every 2 years, a biennial budget, and it's always on an odd number year. They pass the supplemental in even number years. So 2019 is going to be a big biennial budget year. The agency gets started as early as April, starting to solicit ideas for budget items. The executive management team starts to look at those and weigh them based on how well they align with our strategic plan, how much they cost, how much momentum they already have at the legislative level, and other factors. And then we package them, the highest priority ones, and bring them to the commission generally in August and September, but as Nate said, this year earlier to try to get your guys' early feedback. And then we take those to the governor and OFM in mid-September to hopefully get them included in the governor's budget, which is released in December. That's a critical first step because the legislature uses the governor's budget as kind of the starting point for their negotiations. So if we don't get in there, it's a really tough challenge to get our stuff in at all. On the bill side, the legislature starts second Monday in January every year. They start really fast. We have to have our bills with a sponsor signed and dropped in the first week of session if we want to get them heard. Cutoffs come quick. They have to make it through policy committee, fiscal committee, through the rules committee, and off the floor through the next chamber and over to the governor's desk. It's a huge challenge, lots of steps along the way. Only 20% of the thousands of bills each year actually make it to the governor's desk. The process is really built to vet bills, and so if it's not an idea that's been well vetted before session even starts, a lot of times it really doesn't have a chance of making it through. So We, as a policy team, do a ton of work before session to make sure our bills fit into that 20% category. We get in front of you guys early. We get in front of advisory boards early. We get out to the public early. We work with sponsors to identify people that are passionate about the issue and get them involved in shaping the idea during the summer months. And then this year, we're actually developing a formal outreach strategy to include presentations to not only our advisory boards and our commission, but also to partner groups so we can get their feedback and support early. We're also thinking about doing some legislative tours that are focused on building exposure on our issues, getting out to do some editorial boards, and doing some public webinars on our budget challenges. So if we do our job right, when session starts in January, we turn to the purely mechanical steps of passing a bill, right? We've done the hard work of getting people behind the concept, and we really just have to get it through the trenches of session. And that includes everything from requesting a hearing to requesting rules, pulls, requests, writing speaking points for our sponsors, working on amendments, and just keeping all of our different partner groups in the loop on progress.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Raquel, how do you work in, how do you think about meeting with legislators outside of session? This is a great time, except for the elections coming up. So when it's election year, how, because I, you know, I have a really important representative in my neighborhood, really want to help with this. I know him. So how do you work out those timings, and when can you come over? When do you think is a good time to come over? And he's running for, yeah, but, you know, it's probably a shoe-in, but well, still, he's working, so.
Definitely, and let's definitely try to get an in-district meeting. Those are usually easier to get mm-hmm. during the interim than catching them when they're in Olympia. Yeah. A lot of times we also look at what committees they might be on that are working in the interim, so we'll be meeting with Representative Ormsby, I think, when he's in town for his next pension subcommittee meeting.
Okay.
We try to catch them when they happen to be here. Also, just because knowing sure. their schedules are really hectic, but we'd love to have you along on that one.
Okay.
Be a good one to have you join.
Great.
So just so you guys know, we usually introduce about 3 to 5 agency request bills every year. That seems to be the right amount. We don't want to overload ourselves, knowing that we have around 200 to 400 other bills every year that are introduced that in some fashion impact our agency. We've got a really broad mission, so we end up tracking everything from HR policies to environmental permitting policies, energy bills, anything that's got a law enforcement or gun angle. There's just a ton of bills that we end up tracking. And we need to read and actually analyze every single one of those 200 to 400 bills that impact us. We do that by assigning a lead in the program, and that person helps us do an analysis, figure out the policy impacts, the fiscal impacts, whether we need to actually testify on the bill or if we need, in worst case scenario, some changes to the bill. And then we meet weekly on Fridays as a legislative coordination team. It's a group of about 20 to 30 people from throughout the programs and the policy team. And that group talks about things that happened during that week, any follow-up we need to do based on questions we got from committees. And then we look at the schedule for the next week to make sure we've got coverage for hearings, people going to testify, and folks there to meet with legislators wherever we need them. We also have developed a formal process for capturing and tracking legislative correspondence. We get about 20 inquiries from members' offices in the interim and even more during session, and that's a monthly number. And those can be anything from, you know, I have a constituent that's frustrated with their hunting license or the process they went through with that, or a really challenging permitting question that may take a few people getting together with the county or city to actually hash it out. So they can be small, big, short to resolve, or really challenging to resolve. So we capture those. It seems small, but it's a really been beneficial to our relationships with legislators to get them timely responses. It just is helping with our trust and transparency, I think, across the street. So what's coming in 2019? It's, go ahead, Joe.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Kelly might tell the commissioners a little bit about the letter we sent out to candidates.
Oh, yeah. So this year we did something new. Joe sent a letter, which I think was really, really helpful to all of the candidates running for office, that basically said, we know fish and wildlife issues come up during public meetings, during the election season. They're tough issues. Here's a few details about the work we do, but just know that we're a resource for you, and feel free to contact us if you have any questions on any of our work. And we have just had incredibly good feedback on that. A lot of questions rolling in, and just really good connections being made between us and candidates. So 2019 is going to be another big election year. We've got the entire House of Representatives is up for election, and probably about a half of the Senate, too. We had a lot of retirements last year. So around 115 to 120 of the seats over at the legislature will be up for election, which means we're going to have a lot of new faces, a lot of meet and greets to do next session, early in session, with our director. And it's also the first biennial budget we'll see pass since McCleary was resolved. That's really exciting for a lot of us. We've also had some great revenue forecasts since the 2017 biennium, and so there's a lot of hope that there's going to be a little bit more general fund than we've seen in past years available. But we're not the only people thinking that way. All of the other natural resource agencies are also watching the general fund, and we're already getting a heads up from the governor's office in OFM that we need to tamper our excitement and be realistic and bring forward ideas that have sustainability in mind. They want us looking at long-term revenue sources. They're really worried about another recession potentially between now and 2023, so they don't want us hedging all of our bets on the general fund. So we're thinking a lot about that. Next year, the legislature is going to make mental health a top priority. They're going to be looking at whether or not the carbon tax passes on the ballot, some potential bills on the carbon tax. And then, of course, there's going to continue to be a lot of momentum on salmon recovery and southern resident killer whale recovery, which our agency will be heavily involved in. And I'll turn it over to Nate to talk about the federal side.
Great. And Megan West is our federal coordinator in the director's office. She just does an outstanding job keeping folks in touch with the Washington congressional delegation, really recognizing that about almost a third of our budget comes from federal sources. So it's really important that we're tracking the federal process. Obviously, the Congress determines the amount of federal funding and are adopting bills, and that there's the context here is there's a nationwide competition, not only just from the National Marine Fisheries Service or for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but all the other agencies and all the other states that are clamoring for that attention. So it's really important that we have good relationships with staff and with some of the consortiums like the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies that can help get our perspectives and interests represented with the right folks in Congress. Just a quick overview of the congressional composition. There are 10 districts in Washington. There's a typo on your hard copy. It says 8. So just wanted to correct that. And congressmen, women serve two-year terms. Of course, we have two Washington senators serving 6 terms. The Washington congressional delegation is poised really well because 4 of our members sit on different appropriations committees. So we're in a spot for influencing those outcomes very well. The Congress operates year-round with intermittent recesses and operate under a 2-year legislative cycle. So similar to what happens on the state side, when a bill is introduced, it can resurface again. It's alive for 2 years. So at the end of December, basically January 2nd or 3rd of 2019, all the bills in play right now essentially die, and then Congress would need to resubmit in early January 2019. In terms of how the department engages on developing the federal budget, we start by asking the different resource programs for their ideas on important initiatives for appropriations requests. The director's office finalizes that request in December, and then submit that to both the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, as well as through the governor's DC office, to make sure that they're aware of the agency requests and priorities. Typically, the president introduces the budget in February, and then in April and May, the House and Senate develop appropriations bill, ultimately get those adopted by the end of September for the start of the new fiscal year in October. That's in the ideal scenario. We've been operating, Congress has been operating under a continuing resolution kind of format here for several years, where they just kind of keep the budget open for 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, the end of the year, and then they're back at it again. So this most recent cycle was one where we actually had the budget through the end of the fiscal year, and that was refreshing. So wanted to just show you where some of the different agency fundings reside in the different committees in Congress. National Marine Fisheries Service is housed under the Commerce, Science, and Justice Committee, and you can see listed some of the programs that we typically advocate for full funding. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is, of course, under the Interior Committee, and there we're watching things like state and tribal wildlife grants, funding for our hatchery genetic management plans and mass marking. And we're also paying attention to a variety of other committees, energy and water, and looking out for agencies like Department of Ag or EPA, Bureau of Land Management, and the Department of Defense. All of those agencies are folks that we typically can contract with or doing important work within Washington State. We're wanting to make sure that they're adequately funded.
Nate, do we do anything with Bureau of Rec?
Yes, and in particular with the Yakima Basin Integrated Water Management Plan. So, looking at some of the bills that we're tracking, Recovering America's Wildlife Act is a really important bill. We've talked about it. This is being a game changer and really ramping up funding for biodiversity across the country. Earlier this morning, we talked about Congresswoman Herrera Butler's bill called Endangered Salmon and Fisheries Predation Prevention Act. We're tracking the PR Modernization Act and a number of others listed. One I should also call out is the Farm Bill reauthorization. Huge opportunities here for conservation on private land in Washington is based through funding that goes through the Natural Resources Conservation Service and Farm Service Agency. So that's one that we track a variety of different conservation programs and advocate for, both at the DC level as then as money is coming to the region and through the state, and even working at local technical groups. We're always trying to make sure that wildlife habitat values are reflected in each of those steps. Megan probably handles 3 to 4 calls a day from the congressional delegation staffers on asking for our feedback on different bills or different budget component. We also work very closely with the governor's D.C. office because they're working through the Western Governors Association or the National Governors Association on various federal platforms. So that's another conduit for us to try to influence Congress. And then lastly, we partner and coordinate our position with tribes and NGOs, the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, and across the state family to make sure that conservation opportunities in Washington are funded. So kind of steering back now through that orientation about back to the blue sheet of how is the commission engaging on different legislative processes. In general, and just share that I think it's definitely a green light as far as you all being able to support and speak to anything that was commission-approved action. So the commission adopted a policy statement or a position statement. When the agency advances agency request legislation that you approve, or you approve our budget requests, or items that are really clearly articulated and consistent with the strategic plan. In other instances, and I think, you know, Commissioner McIsaac, you reflected on, you know, a staffer asking for your position on the pinniped bill, and you clarified, well, here's your thoughts as a citizen, but can't speak on behalf of the entire commission. And then I would just wanted to offer that the third avenue is certainly turning over those questions to the director, myself, or Raquel, and we can help engage. And I wanted to put in that context of, you know, we're tracking a couple hundred bills during the state legislative session, and sometimes we have to come up with an agency position within 48 hours to testify on it. So we're moving very quickly. We're analyzing these and moving forward. And so we don't have this role explicitly clarified within the director's delegation memo. So if that's something that we want to clarify going forward, that would be good. But we are very actively, and because of the short turnaround and time frame, I just think that even though the commission is the highest level policy body within the agency, how would we go about asking for feedback constantly on various positions and bills that are dropped? It is critical right now for those in-district meetings. Commissioner Thorburn, great point about meeting with folks in district. Now's the time. Commissioner Graybill attending the meeting of the tour a couple weeks ago. That is a very welcome engagement. Would love to have your all's participation in those events. We'll make sure to get you information about upcoming tours this summer, and hopefully you can participate. I know there's a lot of requests from commissioners to also meet with legislators during the session, and just know that that becomes really challenging, because oftentimes we're trying to meet with the committee chairs or appropriators. They're slammed. I mean, their calendars, they're meeting every 15 minutes. There's a new person moving into their door. And so thinking about how do we have nine commissioners meet with the chair of Natural Resources Committee, that would be really tough and a lot to ask for those individuals. But perhaps something that we consider is there something where we have a commission day where a number of you come in and we try to line up different briefings with legislators so that you all have access and can talk about the agency request legislation and important budget priorities. Before I shift to others, I just wanted to take any questions.
Go ahead, Bob.
I think that's an excellent idea. Count me down. Look, as a person that would be more than willing to do that, particularly when we're going to be throwing out this big, well, we'll see what we throw out, but I think it's critical, and I think it's an excellent idea. So.
Yeah, great comments. Sometimes they have to sleep during the day, don't they, Raquel?
Yeah.
It's true.
And also, you know, I know there are hearings that are scheduled on different topics, and if we can be alerted to appropriate hearings, that'd be helpful.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think if we knew more about it, you know, to try and connect with some of these folks, that would be really helpful. Don?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. So is this the end of the legislative part of the briefing here?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so I think I'm the one who submitted the blue sheet originally about trying to figure out what the commission's policy positions might be on current federal and state proposed legislation, as you show on slide number 4 there. So we just had a discussion about the pinniped question. So that's kind of the question. And so I'm learning here a little bit. When you have 200 and some bills out there and there's a quick response time, obviously that's not going to work, that we're going to know what the commission's position is on a particular bill, because, you know, it's either too quick or there's too many. So I'm just trying to figure out how to get the biggest ones elevated to a point where if we are asked by the key legislator, well, what do you guys want? I mean, that's the kind of question you usually get, is something very simple, and if we can't take a position, that's a display of weakness. Now, that must mean you don't want it too much then. It can't be very important if you don't even have a position. So when we approve a budget, that's an easy one. We've already done that. When we have agency request legislation, I presume that's a biggie that we will know about. That one's done. So if we happen to have a policy position that we've developed, then we got something to fall back on. So I'm not sure how to get anything else that's big in front of us so that we can be useful and not have this unintended consequence of appearing weak and unsupportive on something that's very important to the department. Call somebody at the department is an answer. That's kind of a lame bureaucratic answer that sends the same signal of, well, not very important then, is it? So anyway, I don't know what the answer is, but that's the kind of thing I was thinking about when I put the blue sheet in. I didn't know that the challenge was 250 bills. And the quick turnaround thing is eliminated. So I'll just put that out there as maybe a challenge for everybody. Of when there's a big deal, I guess we got to somehow anticipate it and squeeze it in somewhere. I don't know.
Well, Nate pointed out a couple of examples, Don, where a couple of different approaches that we've taken, and it's on federal legislation, the examples that he gave. We actually developed, as we knew it was coming forward, had been following the Blue Ribbon Committee work, an early policy on RAWA. So we're there. We can go forward. It's a pretty strong position. We can certainly, talk to our congresspeople and staff and everything about RAWA. A second sort of different approach is we recently had a presentation on the Farm Bill conservation programs, and a very clear presentation on what the department is looking for, and it builds on what we've used in Farm Bill programs in the past. I mean, they're really important to our species work in many areas. So I think we have a pretty clear understanding of where we are with the Farm Bill and could go forward on that. And that was a little different way of approaching it. So these are processes that we have. We just haven't done it yet with them.
Leading.
So just as a follow-up then on the Farm Bill situation, which is one that a brand new commissioner like me can remember anyway. When that discussion ends and there hasn't been any negative perspective or objection to anything, and there's a level of enthusiasm at the end of the agenda item, the chair or somebody says, this is all great and wonderful. I hope everybody will support that if asked. That is the moment when we then become free to say, on behalf of the commission, we support the Farm Bill. We would like to see it go forward. All of it, that kind of thing. Okay.
Yeah, and I think just to follow up on that, I mean, that's a great point, Don, actually. I'm glad we're talking about this. It may be appropriate in some instances to draft a letter to our congressional delegation signed by the chair, and vetted. Maybe we can do it if there's things that need to be wordsmithed, do it through a conference call or something like that, and so we just don't have, so it's actually kind of on record, and we can distribute it to our congressional delegation. So
would that help you,
Mr. Chair? Commissioner Keel, that's exactly, I think we want to be thought leaders, opinion leaders, and providing guidance on these bills. So if you're all willing to do that, we'd want to support that. So either the position statements or the letters, that'd be good.
Yeah.
Agreed? Yeah. We'll do that.
I know that we were having a problem with Noah signing off on all of our hatchery business, and we did draft a letter.
GMPs.
That helped, and I think that was the first time that we'd ever done that as a commission, but I think there's other opportunities, and we should do that.
I think it should almost be like boilerplate for these federal issues that, that we support, and, if you request, on that, because we don't want to get cross purposes here. So
they're going to help with the letter.
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah, because and they have the basic knowledge that we don't have individually. Right.
And the federal congressional
start at that end.
And the congressional bill development process is a lot slower, and so we'd have the time to then bring that forward on a conference call, wordsmith the language, and get a letter out where it would still be impactful. So
good.
One last question about timing on the state process, when it might be useful. As I don't know if this is a December or a January or somewhere in their time frame, as you get to the point where you know what's coming down the pike and you could sort that through and say, well, there are three biggies we understand are probably going to come in. You haven't heard about them yet. You might think of when we could schedule a briefing for the commission that's timely so that we could have the same kind of farm bill type informal discussion. And if everybody's comfortable without having, if you have to draft a position statement or pass a motion, that's a little more difficult. But just an understanding so that we could enthusiastically support or enthusiastically oppose a particular thing. So maybe, I don't know when the right time is, but maybe you could think about that.
I like that idea. We certainly have a sense by November, December of bill ideas that are out there that may be trickier than others. I'm thinking of net pens last year. We knew October, November that was going to be a hot topic. So we can bring you maybe a list in the fall of those big, gnarly issues that are likely to be in front of us in 2019.
Maybe that's something we can put on our year at a glance general planner.
Yeah, thanks, Commissioner McIsaac. We typically will also, a couple of things. We will usually have a legislative update on the agenda for meetings during the session. We try to make use of emails and phone calls on, you know, hot topics that have short fuses. And there have been times in the past where, as you suggested, set aside a special meeting or a call around a particular issue that has a lot of you know, impacts potential to it. So
that's a good point, Joe. I also, Commissioner Graybill brought up the point of commission getting a heads up on hearings that are coming up, and something that I can start doing in this next session is sending out that next week's hearing schedule so you guys know the types of hearings that we're going to be going and attending, just in case there are issues that you're interested in. Just know that they do get scheduled like on Thursday for the next week, so it's usually a really quick turnaround time, so it's not always conducive to traveling over for, but we can give you as much heads up as we can to get you there.
Yeah, and for folks too that are interested on their own, the legislature has a great website, and you can all the meetings are on the calendar. You can type in any keyword about a bill that you might be interested in, so and it's really easy. So that I would encourage, if you're interested in doing that, taking advantage of that resource too.
I think in some of the other direction, where like in my work I get involved with you know, working towards these what's called Rangeland Fire Protection Associations, and Representative Dent had a bill last year that didn't make it. It had some opposition from fire chiefs and a few folks, other legislators that had fire operation concerns. And so we're reworking it. We're looking at it again just in my everyday job. Would the department want to hear about that? And then, you know, weighing in from the department's side, you know, this is the type of thing that could have possibly helped avoid the Sutherland fire that killed so many pygmy rabbits, you know. So would you like to hear, or do you know about those things, or do you
Absolutely.
Want to hear about them?
So we're engaged in a lot of the forest health and prescribed fire work groups that are going on, but if there are other conversations that you're a part of and you're not seeing us there, let us know. We want to be a part of those conversations, definitely. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so we'll shift now to talking about the operating budget. And just as a reminder, I mean, when I start going through numbers and talking about general fund state or wildlife state, it's really easy to just look at these and start thinking about just rows on a spreadsheet. But this is all to implement our mission of conserving fish and wildlife and ecosystems and providing sustainable opportunity. And each one of those activities, whether it's an enforcement officer patrol, or it's a district biologist writing an HPA, or it's a wildlife area manager, there is a series of different fund sources that are stitched together to make that work possible.
Yeah, so, Nate, germane to our conversation last night, conserve fish and wildlife.
That's right. Completely agree. also, as we talk about budget, let's also talk about the department's economic impact and you know, numbers that we've pulled together on various outreach materials and citing U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service data data from NOAA Fisheries. In total, with hunting and sport fishing and wildlife watching and commercial fishing and wholesale markets, it's about $4.3 billion of economic activity in Washington associated with work that we manage. Just looking at a report from the state's Department of Revenue from 2017, is that the general fund state impact from fishing and hunting and outdoor recreation is $334 million. And you look at the amount of general fund that's appropriated to the department, it's $94 million per biennium. So one way to look at that is you invest in general fund in the department, you get a 350% return on the state's investment. This was a really helpful report, and for us to try to demonstrate the value of general fund, because this is the picture that we've been dealing with. And I'm going to go through a little bit about the context of some of the proposals that we're hoping to resolve. So going back to 07-09, where the agency had $110 million of general fund, you can see a big chunk was removed in 09-11, further decline into 11-13, and then slowly building back up with either buying back old work or dealing with inflation, or in some cases there's some new work that was appropriated. But let's investigate it a little bit further. If you look at just our base funding and you back out all the one-time appropriations, that reflects in that trend. Further, if you were to look at buying power, in some cases the legislature removed general fund state but shifted our activities to another fund sources. So that actually restored some of the buying power. So for instance, here in 13-15, there was probably $10 million or so of a fund shift to try to help replace the general fund that was repurposed elsewhere. What I mean by is if, for instance, we previously had $80 million of general fund, they may have given us $70 million of general fund and $10 million of ALEA, okay. And thus we would still have $80 million of buying power. So I probably should come up with a better word, but that's what we were trying to just get through to explain what happens with fund shifts as well as with one time. But when we look back, and there was still almost $25 million reduction that we haven't seen fully replaced. And if you were to apply just a basic inflation value to that, that would be a $32 million of buying power that we haven't been fully restored. Switching over to the state wildlife account and just looking at that authority. This is information we've presented in the past, and that the legislature balances the budget. They give us the spending authority, but they didn't provide us the revenue vehicle behind it. And so the books are balanced when they look at the legislative budget. When they look at the agency budget, we start having this structural deficit because they've given us permission to spend the money that we don't have revenue coming in. So how do we make up for that? Well, we've been tapping fund balance. And that's how we were able to try to balance the budget this biennium, as we will likely no longer have any fund balance at the end of this biennium. We've been really aggressively budgeting. So in the 2017 legislative session, we projected a shortfall of $25 million. About half of that was associated with that structural deficit I represented on the previous slide, as well as there was a series of needs associated with maintaining fishing, in particular with new federal ESA requirements. The budget shortfall was partially addressed with one-time infusion of general fund state at the tune of $10.1 million. The legislature also added $2 million of additional cuts, bringing our total budget problem statement for this biennium to $27 million. So we presented this to you in a lot of detail at your September meeting. but just going through some of the solutions. Here's where the $10.1 million of general fund. We reduced the wildlife account reserves. So this has to do with how much money that we set aside to account for the ebb and flow of license revenue. Generally, you try to have a two-month reserve. We're budgeting right now at a one-month reserve. We've delayed equipment purchases at the tune of $4.5 million. The way we have achieved that is we've implemented a vacancy rate model in all the program's budgets. Typically, what we'd have is if you're a program administrator, you kind of get down to either month 12 or 11 or so of the first fiscal year or month 23 of the biennium, and you're looking at your account balances and saying, hey, you know, I can go ahead and buy that new tractor, or we can buy some fish food, or we can buy, do an additional survey. By implementing this vacancy rate model, that ability to take advantage of unanticipated positive variances is gone. We're making sure, and this was a matrix finding from the operational assessment report from that was completed in January, but we're making sure all of our fund sources are paying their fair share of administrative costs so that the general fund or hunters and fishers are not subsidizing the indirect work on all the other accounts that we manage. We also used restricted fund balances. So we had a lot of that authority that we were able to apply to some of our different restricted accounts and push more activities onto that work where it was consistent. And then we still had to cut $6 million from services this year. I'm saying that in that the public won't see these reductions. We do a good job managing our budget. We're very aggressive on how we manage budget. We don't want to cut services. But at the same time, looking at this list, there's $22 million of that $27 million identified is a one-time solution.
On all funds paying fair share of administrative costs, is our federal indirect, or do we have only one or more, does it pay the fair share of administrative?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Thorburn, that's a good question. And yes, all of our federal contracts pay indirect. What we were looking at here is more of the internal accounts, and we were making sure that each one of those accounts, so for instance, a restricted account and the state wildlife account is like the Puget Sound crab. So we wanted to make sure that indirect was being charged associated with that work, so it wasn't just subsidized through other hunting and fishing license revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So that last statement was kind of powerful. $22 million is a one-time solution. So, you know, I imagine there are some folks across the street there who said, well, let's see how these folks do. They got $27 million. If they can solve that on their own, that means they had too much money to start with. So if you have to solve the problem by taking it out of your rainy day fund, which I think is what you're saying about the $22 million, it's a one-time thing, then that's a powerful argument. I wonder how you get the $22 million, the delay equipment purchases and the vacancy rate. You know, back in the old days, they called that the vacuum cleaner. So anytime there was a vacancy, the vacuum cleaner went out and vacuumed up all that money. But I don't know that that's a one-time solution. So of the, how do you get to 22 and the rest of it if you're leaving a perception that, well, you know, we cut that away, and like you said, the public doesn't know it's gone, and so it's reinforcing a perspective that, well, maybe that wasn't needed. That's a good thing we asked them to cut, because what they did is they eliminated some unnecessary stuff.
The one time, I mean, half of it comes in this, the appropriation that was set to expire at the end of this biennium. The reducing the account reserves is a one-time strategy. That's not a spot we would like to be in the future. It's not a best management practice from the Office of Financial Management to manage that aggressively. As well as throughout here, there was some other items like we had on this balancing in this $6 million. We had a lot of, for instance, some officer vacancies or some management positions that we've cut that we'll probably need to revisit. So. With that $10.1 million, the legislature adopted a proviso that had three components. And I think this says a lot about the overall relationship status with the legislature in 2017. They asked us to conduct a performance assessment, making sure that we're operating and managing the department well. They asked us to do a zero-based budget analysis. Let's lift up the hood and look at where all the funding resides, and is it being used appropriately and consistent with those fund sources. And then let's develop a long-term funding plan that has that's been vetted with the public. So in other words, to kind of recast that, is let's find efficiencies and eliminate waste, repurpose funding to higher priorities, and then submit a plan to the legislature to secure stable funding. So we've been hard at work at this. I mean, this proviso was in the budget that was adopted June 30th of 2017, and we've been at it every day since. I want to walk through, and I hope this also addresses Commissioner Graybill's concern, just kind of go through a little bit of how we've developed the budget in the past. Budgets are typically developed on incremental need. You assume what you got the previous biennium will roll forward, and then you're submitting requests for new work. Typically, there's little or no evaluation of those existing programs. And then in mid-February, the legislature might ask us, hey, what's the consequences if you don't get new funding? What happens if we end up cutting your agency by $10 million of general fund? Well, what we typically do is just show the types of cuts we'd make within that one fund source. So if the cut was in general fund, we would just look through and say, okay, well, where's our general fund in the agency? And those would be the suite of activities that we're potentially look at for being at risk. And then we would also just submit a proportionate reduction across the programs based on how much general fund was in that program. So it wasn't exactly a strategic look. It wasn't exactly looking at for the lowest priority work and accounting for flexible funding options that we'd have to solve that problem. So we would reveal that, and then some would accuse us of hiding the ball because they would see other work that was going on in the field that they thought was maybe a lower priority than the items that we served up as reductions, and folks would ask, what's that about? So what's different for this round? Well, the organizational assessment that we did this past fall and was completed in January. First, this independent consultant came in and said, yes, the structural deficit is real. This isn't something that the department invented or made up. We have more authority to spend the money than we're currently bringing in, and we don't have enough account balances to have this be sustainable. And there was also no significant, major negative findings on how the department's managing our budget. We also have the benefit of doing the zero-based budget analysis, where we're looking at all flexible fund sources to help try to resolve our budget problem. The agency has been working across programs and specifically focusing on the major outcomes. So rather than focusing on administrative programs, let's look at what is the services that we're doing, and what is the deliverables that we're charged with doing, and let's make sure we're lining up our funding to be successful. We're developing a true carry-forward level budget. This is the budget we would end up having to implement if the legislature did not appropriate new funding. We've established a budget and policy advisory group, and this has just been a great opportunity. I know a number of commissioners have been able to pop in on some of the deliberations of that group. We've got 20 or so opinion leaders from around the state represented in conservation and fishing and hunting organizations, land trusts, and the business community, counties and ag, timber interests are represented. What their findings as they've gone through the budget, and we've been bringing them the same information that we've had at all your workshops, we've been taking to this advisory group. And what they've come to the conclusion is that the department's mission is incredibly important for the state of Washington. The department is inadequately funded to carry out that mission. And of the funding that we do have, there's a $33 million problem statement. And then lastly, they've been working with us and really helping us develop this long-term funding plan on looking at what are some other fund source opportunities, as well as going through and providing some of these findings and recommendations for us to use in the future on how we manage the budget.
What assures this is long-term on the legislative side of things, or that they wouldn't just in 4 or 5 years, or if there's new people coming in, kind of forget about all this and say, okay, you've got a $20 million shortfall, what are you going to do about it again? What assurances that all this is creates a long-term funding scenario?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Keating, that's a really good question, and one that we don't have those guarantees. So right now, when we've gone through and looked at different alternative funding sources, certainly if the Recovering America's Wildlife Act passed, you know, that would be a good, great infusion of federal funds to help us carry out some pretty core conservation work of the agency. Other options we've looked at, and the group's been entertaining about, you know, gosh, is there a way to have a dedicated portion of the sales tax, or is there a component of the real estate excise tax that could be dedicated to this? Politically, those probably aren't viable. Those are things that we'll need to socialize for several years. This plan identifies those and advocates to try to have for a stable fund source. But in the absence of having something adopted that's protected, really, there isn't, as well as the legislature could revisit any of those decisions, even if there was a dedicated portion. So,
listening to your description of past processes and changes, you pulled out. Okay, so we're going to get a cut in general funds. And so we just look to the general fund funded places to cut. Kind of took me aback because as we've gone through this process, one of the terms that you've brought up is flexible funding, and a general fund is one of our flexible funds. So there is an opportunity to kind of look across all programs and priorities. You can move those around and not just be cutting. I mean, if that's been the past practice, one of the things I've always said about government is the reason we call them divisions is they're divided and, you know, breaking down silos and that sort of thing. I'm hearing that go forward, and that's what you can do also with flexible funding. So I just hope that there are processes. It kind of relates to the point, you know, how do we guarantee it's long term? I hope there are processes that we're developing that are going to move forward and actually change our approaches to change the organization, really, in the ways that it needs to be.
If I could just quickly respond, Commissioner Thorburn, I think the proviso work has been very healthy for the agency to go through, and some of the practices of going through and focusing our budget around outcomes rather than administrative programs, looking at potentially flexible fund sources versus just the single fund source that might be at risk. Those are really healthy conversations we're having internally. It's been great having the Budget and Policy Advisory Group and the Commission rolling up your all sleeves and getting involved in the budget and understanding those policy choices. And I think it's a lot stronger for us to make sure that we're keeping our eye on the prize by having more options on the table than what we've had in the past.
Just quickly restate the obvious, and I bet I say this every meeting. One of the ways to answer Commissioner Keeney's question is to remind us that just because we have an agenda with different stuff at different times, this is all connected. And long-term confidence in the department and willing to fund the department will come not from us sitting in 15-minute meetings with legislators, but it's going to come in the citizens of the state understanding what we do, agreeing with what we do, and then them talking to their legislators. Over there, there's a concept of funding policy and values. And the values are where the rubber hits the road. The values are where the citizens and all these interest groups get involved. And that's where we can, and I am so happy to see us thinking about and devising plans to roll up our sleeves, because we can make more impact with our legislators from our areas, with groups that agree with them, and having it be a grassroots movement rather than making Raquel run all over the hill every day. So.
First of all, I want to thank you guys for this. I know it's been a pain in your butt to do this. And you heard me mention it this morning about the rollout of the Wild Futures. As a commissioner, I couldn't defend that. I just couldn't, because from the get-go on that, there was no separation between the wheat and the chaff. It was just throw something out. And I really do appreciate you guys taking the time and going through this. This gives us a defendable position to go to legislatures, go to people, go to everybody, and lay it out. Here's what we've got. Here's what we're going to do. Now, to answer Mr. Keeney's question, and I think Commissioner Carpenter will join in on this. What do we do going forward? This is an ongoing process. When I kick a bull out with a cow, I got 18 months before I'm going to harvest revenue off of that. Do I just kick him out, not pay any attention? No, this is an ongoing process. We can't just run over the goal, slam the football down, and then forget about it. This is something that has to be going on and on and on. And going back, make certain that we're trim, make certain we're running a good business. And I've worn this out. The new director going on, yeah, this is needs to be a big part of their job. Nate, you've stepped up, done an amazingly good job with this whole deal. But there again, we can't spike the football and say, now we're done. So that's what it's going to take going forward to make certain that we do have adequate funding. This is just the beginning and starting to run this place as though it were accountable, and we've got to stay accountable. So, no, I want to thank you. This is a really good presentation.
Thanks, Commissioner.
All the good praise, and I do caution, we're halfway through the presentation, and we have 15 minutes, or 45 minutes.
You bet, Mr. Chair. So, part of the zero-based budget analysis that we did that was in the proviso was dividing up the agency's work into 8 major outcomes. And really, this has been helpful to explain, you know, looking at our mission at the top, why is it that we're here? What is it that we're doing? And how is it that we do that work? This is captured. And then we've been aligning our budget into these various bins. And that's been helping us, because then we're looking at the flexibility of the funding. Certainly, as was pointed out, general fund state or non-restricted wildlife state, where hunting and fishing licenses are primarily deposited, those are a lot more flexible. You can use those across the activities authorized under Title 77, our legislative chapter. As you move further down, I mean, there's federal contracts. We can either accept to do the work or not. But I don't get to take a killer whale contract and then go over and fund the Methow Wildlife Area. When we look at flexibility, one of the things that we did is we identified it as, can we fund more than one outcome with that funding? So, for instance, even a federal fund source like Pittman-Robertson, which is the excise tax on firearms and ammunition, that has pretty tight federal restrictions on what that money can be used for. But we can use it for an outcome such as managing lands, and we can use it for an outcome for managing hunting. And so in that sense, PR was considered flexible. Previously, we would not have considered PR as flexible. So just wanted to kind of give you an example of, as the executive management team was going through 50 fund sources and identifying which ones are we going to put on the table of potentially being at risk. So this gives our best snapshot of what we think is the problem statement for this next biennium. In short, we're looking at $33 million. We reverse all the one-time budget balancing decisions from this current biennium. We know that the Columbia River Salmon Steelhead endorsement expires. We anticipate some inflation, as well as we know that we're on an unsustainable path of we're spending above the projected revenue, totaling $33 million. When we've developed our carry-forward level budget, and by carry-forward level, what I'm trying to say is this is the amount of funding that we'd have absent the $33 million. We looked at the agency's mission and mandate. We applied the criteria that was in the proviso, as well as the executive management team developed some additional criteria, which I'll show on the next slide, to identify $33 million of reductions. And those reductions came put into two categories. One was if it was a permanent reduction that we'd actually go ahead and take this year so that we would reduce the size of the footprint of the request going forward into next biennium. And the other category was $30 million worth of work that we're going to propose as decision packages that the legislature fund and hopefully would not be cut.
Quick question. If you could bounce back to slide 31, which is your $33 million problem statement, that 22.2 gets back to that previous question about one-time things. So the difference between 27 and 22.2 essentially becomes a permanent cut, the way I'm thinking through this. Maybe you can just think about that, whether that's true or false, and that gets to whether vacancy rates and things like that end up being a permanent assumption forever as opposed to some flexibility for people to buy the tractor. Maybe keep that thought in mind.
I have a question as well. I'm sort of scrolling through the slides here. Are we going to talk, or are we going to have a chance to ask a question about the $3 million cut that's... Is it now or?
Yes. No, I'll go okay. through those.
You will go through
yes.
those.
Yes.
Okay, great. I will wait until.
Okay. Just looking at some of the criteria that we applied for identifying $33 million of activities that we would need to reduce for next biennium if we are not able to secure new funding. Again, we applied the budget proviso criteria, and I just wanted to call out a couple other additional components. We really thought about how does that activity contribute towards our ability to conserve fish and wildlife. We thought about whether or not this would a cut would have a long-term impact. We put priorities based on, hey, if a species is native to Washington and federally listed, let's try not to cut that activity versus if we had to, let's cut management work associated with non-native fish. And so on. We considered our obligations, a federal or a co-management responsibility and work associated with that might be different than if we had to go back and ask the commission to amend a WAC or consider a different type of approach on your policy, because those would be a little bit more flexible in terms of this overall scale of flexibility. So of the $33 million shortfall, we identified $3 million of permanent reductions, again, to add to our cuts this year to reduce our problem statement for the next biennium. We anticipate going forward with some sort of general fund ask. I mean, the legislature was able to appropriate $10.1 million this biennium. Hopefully that can be something that can move forward, plus what's another amount we'll be requesting per your guidance and decision on the proceeding with the Columbia River Salmon Steelhead endorsement, and then is there a recreation fee component? So basically looking at there's four levers here, and we'll revisit these in a bit, but what outcomes do you want us to try to pursue as deck packs, the content of those decision packages? What's the right ratio of the fund sources of general fund versus fee? And then what's the overall target amount? And then finally, if there is a fee component, what are the aspects of that fee bill that you'd like us to proceed? And as you change each one of those, it ends up affecting the other. So we'll kind of hone in based on the conversation with you today and with the public input that we receive over the next 6 weeks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So these three potential solutions, at one point there were some thought about some other creative ones. What about a sales tax? What about a property tax? What about an initiative? What about this? What about that? I don't remember when those came up, and if you're going to get to them later, just say so. But, later, are we going to get into any policy decision-type discussions about whether this is the three or there's more?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner McIsaac, we certainly have captured some of those other long-term funding ideas in that funding plan. The political viability of having that pass for in 2019 session so that we can count on that to help balance the budget, I think, is a bit of a stretch. Oftentimes, those ideas take several years and a pretty strong campaign orchestrated around that to get that through. And so at this stage in our solutions, I do not have a unique fund source beyond general fund, a fee bill, or Columbia River Salmon Steelhead endorsement.
Is there going to be another opportunity for a policy decision about taking that political risk or not?
That would be great feedback today so that we can start socializing that this summer.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was thinking the same thing. I talked with one of the members of the budget committee, and he indicated to me that it seemed at this point that, like, the things that Commissioner McIsaac were off the table, like a sales tax. But I would imagine, though, that could be part of the conversation with key legislators, mm-hmm. looking at other options. I guess your logic would be, rather than go forward with that formally, have that as part of the conversation, perhaps, and then get, because the legislators will know better than we do here whether such an idea would be even viable. Is that fair?
Commissioner Kehoe, I think that's a good point. And the Budget and Policy Advisory Group was talking about an initiative and recognized that an initiative would have had to have been filed in May, and they weren't ready really to start talking about what sorts of things would be funded with it and not funded with it. So the conversation, I think, landed at that being a better funding source for some of our new work that will be identified through the strategic planning effort.
I just had a great idea. Car tabs. Oh, maybe.
Right.
Maybe not.
What about head tax?
Yeah.
Just in terms of timing, the airplane read is High Country Times, and they recently had their annual recreation issue, and it was real interesting. They took the outdoor recreation industry to task for having an opposed position to the surtax, and I think this is going to be a growing, the readers of that are gearheads, and they're beginning to start organizing, saying it's time for this really strong industry to get on board, and I think we can start jumping on that movement as well. They really, editorially, the articles, they're all pointing out, hey, this industry is a little two-faced in their environmentalism if they're not willing to step forward and support natural resources monetarily.
So turning to the additional reductions that we've proposed for this biennium, we've proposed closing the OMAC and Natchez hatcheries and shifting that production to other facilities. We're proposing that we cease the triploid trout purchase. We've already have done that this biennium. This would cease that activity going forward next biennium. We've identified five FTEs in IT reductions, and so those reductions will be starting in September and then December, and we're working closely with those affected staff. We had two positions in Lands Division associated with habitat monitoring and restoration. We're backing off some of our volunteer grant assistance, and we're reducing our fish pamphlet production and going to rely more on the fish app, and hopefully folks will download and use that rather than picking up two or three extra copies when they go into a sporting goods store. So in total, that would come up to $3 million in efficiencies.
We have over 80 hatcheries, and the two that are going to close are over in our area. And so I got to understand why these were selected out of all the different options that are available out there. Granted, these are trout hatcheries, but they're not as sexy as steelhead and salmon hatcheries, but these service the bread and butter of our license sales. Almost 20 years ago, I had a presentation by Heather Bartlett at the time. She ran the OMAC hatchery. And I was very impressed with her presentation because she lined it out, made it very simple. It cost me $1 million to raise the fish that we plant in Okanagan County Lakes. The return, based on a very conservative day trip cost to harvest those trout, was $4 million to the county. And that was a long time ago. And those hatcheries, I was impressed because I looked at it like a business. It wasn't a social approach or anything else. Cost me $1 million, it brings $4 million back. And so I'm going to have to answer questions about why these two were selected. And so let's hear it.
Commissioner Graybill, that's a great question. And I wanted to start by saying that first off, we're confident that we'll be able to shift the production to other facilities. So the economic impact and the impact to the anglers, we don't anticipate.
Right.
Because the production will be made up. These are older facilities. The Natchez hatchery would require a substantial capital investment because it has some water supply issues. Okay. So we would need to invest pretty significantly to bring that one up to where it can continue. So it's facing tough challenges anyway. And we probably need to think about shifting the production. What does impact here is certainly those local community values of having the hatchery there and being able to do school tours and knowing that the fish that they go fishing for are just raised kind of right up the street. So that's an impact that we recognize. It would be don't have a replacement lined up yet. I've talked with Commissioner Thorburn and with Regional Director Jim Brown, and for instance, the OMAC facility, is there a partnership that we could explore similar to what we've done with the Colville Hatchery, where there's still that educational opportunity, but really minimize the amount of production costs that it takes. So we still have several months here. I mean, we're not closing the doors yet. We're going to see through the production through next spring and then continue to look for partnership opportunities.
I have three. I'll ask all three. Do we need to be prepared for any pushback on the triploid trout purchase, either those places that raise them or the fishers? Just do we need to be prepared on that? On the habitat monitoring, is that cutting out or cutting back on ecologic integrity monitoring? And then the third one is I need some to understand how the ALEA is a reduction. Aren't we just granted the ALEA funding, and will that just be shifted? We'll have less volunteer grant availability, and it will be shifted into other uses.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Thorburn, to answer your third question, yes, that's correct. So it would just be reducing the amount that goes out for the grant opportunity and shifting it to other areas that we're
not eliminating the grants altogether.
It would go back to the level I believe we had at last biennium.
Okay, yeah, I figured. Okay.
The triploid trout purchase, those are, we're buying those, I believe, through private vendors.
Right.
As far as for angling opportunity, that has generated some buzz we're planning most of the fish, but having some additional larger trout to release, that is something that will be impacted, I would think. And then as far as the ecological integrity monitoring, yes. So the two lands position, one is a position that's anticipated to retire this year, doing more of our prairie restoration work in South Sound. And then the other position helps coordinate volunteers to help us with the ecological integrity monitoring.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This line of questioning is meant to respect that you guys have thought a lot about this. These are kind of policy decisions that probably needed to be made, and so anyway, I want to respect all the thinking that went into it. But on the surface, characterizing these as efficiency reductions kind of plays into the mentality of some people that, you know, these are things that should have been done. And so I don't understand the OMAC and Natchez hatchery cuts being efficiencies. If you track that down through the last set of dominoes that I heard ends up at Mossy Rock from mitigation trout obligations being bought somewhere else. So I just don't understand how that one goes. I don't know that the people who love to fish for triploid trout who won't be able to do it anymore are going to be satisfied with a bureaucratic answer, well, that was an efficiency, why you don't get to do that anymore. IT, five FTEs, you know, as we look over time, if this ends up being kind of a permanent efficiency, I'm looking for more IT. We got the apps coming out, and we got all that kind of stuff, and that's where the future is in the world of IT. Now, again, I'm saying this with respect that there's some thought there. I have no idea what those five FTEs do, but in general, if someone out there over there hears that there's some efficiencies and you're cutting IT staff, I wonder what they'll think when we ask for more. Mm-hmm. Habitat monitoring and restorations, pretty important stuff, and so calling that an efficiency reduction, I don't know what's there, but the impression might not be positive. Volunteer grant assistance going away, I wonder who might be upset about that. The training fund, you know, we want the staff to be trained up to be the top staff in the entire country, and I also know training funds don't usually get used either because everybody's too busy, so there's a dynamic there. But again, if this is called an efficiency reduction, and through the math, it never comes back again, ever, I wonder if we call them just cuts. We don't call them efficiencies. We want these things. We don't want to cut them back. And if you're going to bring them back alive later, then maybe a different choice than efficiencies might be in order.
Appreciate the feedback on the title here. Just real briefly, I agree. We've invested quite a bit in IT recently, and we have requests going forward that includes for new IT capacities. In this instance, we've found, I would characterize these as efficiencies, that we had, we've purchased some new software, for instance, that allows us to remote in to employees' computers that need desktop support. So rather than having an IT person drive across the state to help that individual, they can now access it remotely. So that was able to save three FTEs. We recently had hired an IT administrator to help us review all of our vendor contracts. We found a bunch of efficiencies where we had different services and different contracts, and that individual was consolidating that work, and after a couple years, almost work themselves out of a job. And so that would be another position that we would reduce. So anyway, and those we have that kind of similar storyline throughout most of these.
And I urge you to look for those efficiencies. That's a good job to do that. We should do that. Yeah. I just am not following all of them as a decision to say this was, and as we get into the next $30 million, when you're asking for a policy blessing on this,
Jay.
Thank you. A couple of questions on the OMAC hatchery, and it's about, I don't know, two blocks from my house. I walk by there quite a bit, which I happen to notice over the last year, there's a lot of money was put into redoing a lot of their pens. I don't know if that's a $500,000 or $1 million, but they've totally been redone. And seeing that, I was kind of encouraged. I was like, oh, great, you know, this is going to be around a while. So I'd like a little bit of thought on to that from you, because some could say, well, wow, you wasted a lot of money putting it right in there, and now it's gone. Second, and I'm not here to say you've not made a correct decision. I understand if you've looked at that the fish can be produced elsewhere. Okay, I can get that. But there's also an office there, and as I understand it, there's other employees there other than just hatchery folks. So my question is that office going to stay open? And if not, would you be having to build a new office somewhere? Again, maybe it's not as efficient as we would think. So I'm just curious about that. And then third, I'm real curious as to what our elected officials might have had to say about it when they were informed. So, because they haven't contacted me.
Thanks. I will need to circle back on the amount of the capital investments over time on the OMAC hatchery. I don't have that information here. The second question about the facility, raised that with the regional director, Jim Brown, and still looking at for options there. I don't know if it would still have some of the office components there. The trout production would be shifted elsewhere, but we'd still use that facility, or would we look at another alternative? So we haven't landed on a solution to that one yet. And then we did contact affected legislators. I think heard from some with the concerns and understanding about the efficiencies, and others have pushed back and really raising that community value of having a hatchery in their area. So,
and I guess I ask because if you're spending a buck to save a buck, you know, so if you're going to have to go find new office space at a higher rate, because that's not a fancy office, but there's enforcement people work there. There's, I think that's where the conflict specialist office is. And where are they going to end up? And if they do end up there, okay, that's a point that we are saving money by laying off some of the hatchery folks. The fish are being produced elsewhere. But if it's, you know, that new construction is just finished, that threw me a little bit.
And Commissioner Kinney, I just want to jump in briefly. These have been really tough conversations, really, really tough conversations. The OMAC hatchery did just get, I think it was around $400,000 in the last capital budget cycle. That's been a really big challenge for the members that helped get that funding for us. It's a big part of the reason they're frustrated. They're also really frustrated just about good paying jobs in their district. I heard in the calls that I had about a big industry just leaving, and this is just another couple high-paying, good government jobs with benefits that are leaving the district. So these are tough conversations, and I know Joe has been helping think through some additional messaging, and we're thinking about not only some letters that provide some more detail on the cuts and the rationale, but also the overall budget challenge that can help people wrap their heads around why these two facilities are being proposed.
Yeah, I want to give a little bit of context here and a couple of points. Nate said earlier that if we were to go down the path of closing these two hatcheries, we would only do that after the 2019 fish had been released. So these hatcheries are going to operate essentially until we get, and after we get through the next session. So, you know, this isn't something that's going to happen immediately, and there'll be time to hear from everybody about what we might do here. When we get to the $30 million cuts, you're going to see, I think it's 8 additional hatcheries. And, you know, hatcheries are almost impossible for us. We've had these discussions in the past, but it's almost impossible for us to close. But if you look at what $30 million means to the agency, you almost have to go there. And that's what we're trying to get people to see, is the detail around the trade-offs, the this or that, what do we cut. And so I appreciate you all pushing hard on us in terms of putting these out there, how we message about them, et cetera, because it's going to be a real tough discussion.
So let's just do a couple more cuts. I do caution, yeah. We have 20 minutes and we have another 15 pages of equally good content to go through. So
I just wanted to say real quick that WDFW in my part of the world isn't always looked on in the best light. It never has been, never will be.
No.
And so things like this really do hurt. The overall, we talk about image and outreach and you know, yeah, we need to do a better job at that. Well, this is, and I can understand the money side of it, but this really hurts. I mean, it's just another, they don't care about us. They don't even care about the jobs we have here. Why wouldn't we just put $500,000 into is on the first level where you're not even going to talk about it. They're just cut. I don't know. It just doesn't sit well with me, and I know it probably won't sit well with a lot of people.
Let's do two more, and then it was raised to my attention. I think I agree with it. Let's go through the rest of the presentation. Then we'll take questions at the end, because if not, we could do this line by line, which would be okay. So Dave, then Larry can shut it out.
I wanted to echo what Jay said. Last year, there was an announcement that we acquired funding to improve facilities on a whole bunch of hatcheries on the west side. My Facebook page said, well, what about us? You know, that's, again, just reflects what Jay's saying. We're looking for support for this budget cycle. This could do a lot of damage. That's my position. We got to be sensitive.
This goes back a little bit to the discussion we had, I don't know, half hour, 45 minutes ago about marketing. You know, marketing / messaging. I mean, I look at this, I go back a couple slides, and you get down to the fee increase, and you got three question marks there. So how are we going to craft a fee increase? We got two hatcheries closing, at least, that we've already talked about, not to mention the ones forthcoming, and a reduction in triploid opportunity. So we're having a significant reduction in opportunity for our customer base, but yeah, we're going to go to them needing more money. I think we better get a marketing person on board here and message this correctly, or I don't think it's going to work as well as we might think. So that's just a comment.
Yeah. And commissioners, I mean, I just hope when you look at cutting $33 million out of the agency budget, the alternatives are the other 79 hatcheries, 130 enforcement officers, all the district wildlife biologists, district habitat biologists, district fish biologists, the critical administrative support. We could cut the attorney general's office. I mean, the options that you have in front of us aren't good. Some of the efficiencies that I would use the word efficiency appropriately, and I appreciate the pushback there, but on some of them, that's good governance. On some of these others, yeah, that would be great. So one question would be, instead of us asking for $30 million, should we ask for the 33? I mean, that would be that's guidance that you all can provide us. We've solved we've proposed taking $3 million of reductions now, try to reduce the size of the ask next biennium. If you want to go a different direction, please let us know, and we'll take this off the table. Shifting to what we do have, just as for the draft packages, and I just want to do a quick orientation. So there's three budgets that we're going to be talking about in the 2019 session. The first is a supplemental that closes out the current biennium. So we'll have a placeholder for fire suppression. We've already had a fire on the Weenass. It's early in the season. We still have several months that could potentially escalate. Our operating budget has two primary components. And I just want to orient you to the terms here because it'll get confusing. There's a maintenance level component. That's where it's just the general kind of routine cost of business. Facility rates went up. Fish food went up. The electric bill went up. The payment in lieu of taxes went up on our wildlife areas. Pretty standard budget requests that fall on the maintenance level. Then there's the what's called the performance level, which is a request for new work. We're in a unique situation this biennium because of we're walking in with a significant budget problem statement. So we're going to have to ask to get funded for work that we're already doing, because the money is going to be going away,
otherwise. And so that's where I'm using the word maintain to maintain services, or I'm using the word enhance to identify those new strategic investments. And then, of course, we'll be submitting our capital budget as well. So if you look at the $30 million problem statement that's remaining, and again, if the commission chooses to say, no, let's go back and ask for $33 million, we will revisit the math here. But what we've done is we've looked at a variety of work, and then as you're developing what's called decision packages, you try to consolidate similar themes of work into bundles that can just serve as a single line item within a budget. So one line item would be for us to maintain wildlife conflict response. Without $4.4 million, we'd have to reduce our response from 22 FTEs to 8 FTEs, and it would cut 3 enforcement officers. There's an impact from federal grant eligibility that we would also need to resolve, and we think it's an appropriate fund source to have this be funded by general fund versus hunters and fishers. Another request is for $2.5 million for us to maintain our enforcement patrols, to maintain public health and do all the shellfish patrols. We have another request for $2.7 million for us to maintain land management. In particular, this is going for weed control, some of our wildlife area planning and research science support. There's a forest health position and real estate services. Combined, it's about 6 FTEs. Continuing on under the $30 million request to maintain services, we're requesting $3.2 million in wildlife state. And that would be for maintaining hunting. This is, would go towards game species research. It would support pheasant hunting opportunities and maintain our hunter education services. Total about 8 FTEs. We have almost $2 million in fees requested to maintain our customer service. This would fund 13 FTEs within headquarters and regional offices. We have another request for $3.5 million for maintaining our conservation work. This has everything from species status assessments to climate change capacity, our ability to retrieve derelict fishing gear and maintain our presence on addressing aquatic invasive species. Total about 6 FTEs. So again, when we look at the choices that we have, this is a $30 million package that we're really hoping that we can secure funding for. These are cuts that none of us want to take. There's $8.6 million in a decision package associated with maintaining fishing and hatchery production. You can see the salmon and trout hatcheries listed here. Our warm water game fish program would be at risk, as well as our ability to rehab lakes for stocking. The Bingham Creek and Chehalis River trap operations would be impacted, as well as compliance for early winter steelhead fisheries. We'd be backing off work that we do to support recreational shellfish, both on the outer coast as well as Puget Sound, and reduce bottom trawls for surveys for rockfish at about 50%. In total, this package would support 40 FTEs. This is one that we didn't really have options. The Columbia River Salmon Steelhead endorsement is set to expire, so we're requesting the spending authority and hopefully a bill to renew or ideally make this permanent. But that $3.3 million goes towards 3 enforcement FTEs, and there's about 50 staff within the FISH program that code to Columbia River Salmon Steelhead endorsement. So it sums to about 10 FTEs total in terms of personnel hours, but it'll be a real administrative headache how to figure out how to reduce 50 people or pulling 10 FTEs out of 50 positions. And then lastly, in that $30 million of all those packages that's included, there is indirect impacts that's incorporated in each one of those. So there's essentially $23.7 million of direct impacts and $6.3 million of indirect impacts. I just wanted to make sure that you're aware of that this would also have further reductions in IT and HR and in the director's office. It's about 25 FTEs combined. So that's where, and really looking at the some of the dialogue from the Budget and Policy Advisory Group, That's just to kind of keep us stable. But there's recognition that we don't have the funding to fully implement the agency's mission. And so looking forward, we've developed a number of decision packages that would be for new critical work for us to achieve our mission. Where we have a draft package for almost $1 million to keep the regional fisheries enhancement groups going. And we have a request for $14.7 million in general fund for conservation. Really, this would be a focus on watershed health, our ability to partner with local governments, providing technical support to landowners, and improving our work at the urban wildland interface. We have almost 250 species of greatest conservation need, and we're barely able to scratch the surface on just a handful of them, of what we need to do to understand the habitat associations and work to protect them. So we have some statewide and regional capacity to do this work. We identified a need for almost $3.5 million for general fund to enhance lands operations and maintenance. In the past few years, we've bought the equivalent of 3 new wildlife areas. We manage those because an existing wildlife area manager incorporates that new land base within their purview and stretching them a little bit thinner. So we're trying to make them have additional support and recognize the work that is needed. We have one rangeland ecologist right now, and we have a big initiative with working lands and making sure that we have the ecological monitoring to make sure that we're conducting the grazing prescriptions appropriately and consistent with the purposes of that wildlife area. So we're trying to have an additional FTE to support the grazing monitoring. And we also have a need for additional weed control and an additional enforcement officer within each region to help patrol our access sites and our wildlife areas. We've identified a package to enhance fishing opportunities. This would have $1 million in hatchery production, try to meet some of the needs that we have for ESA compliance in Puget Sound associated with the 4D permit that we have for take a Puget Sound Chinook, and then to implement the new Michilac biop on the Columbia River. We're also looking at increasing enforcement, as well as having some IT staff to help maintain the new mobile applications that have been developed. We're looking at $3.5 million to enhance hunting opportunities. This would go to access programs, increasing enforcement, and the general fund state component would be to help us with wildlife conflict response. So again, on the maintain, we have a significant reduction in wildlife conflict. We don't want to have that cut. In fact, we see a need to increase it further. And then lastly, in each of those components would be indirect and some of the priorities that we've identified to be able to invest in if those packages are funded would be outreach, education, and marketing. I think that's been entirely consistent with some of the messages I've been hearing from the commission in the past 24 hours. We also see a need for increased HR for training capacity, particular human dimensions work and conflict resolution for our staff. And then there's some investments that we'd like to make consistent with the Matrix report. One is that we have a variety of different software for managing contracts or budget or fiscal payments. And it'd be nice to have one enterprise software solution to track all of that and have a better window into the agency's financials. We have a placeholder package for southern resident killer whale recovery. We know that the governor's task force will come up with their report in, I believe, October. And so there's a number of elements that we've identified in either the conservation package or the fishing package that may roll into this, or maybe we'd have this as be an addition. Not sure yet, and happy to hear guidance on what you all think we should do there. Just to summarize this budget proposal, and there's different ways that this can all be packaged, but we're looking at $30 million to maintain services and $28.2 million to enhance. And you factor in our maintenance level request, it'd bring the total up to $63.2 million. So this is where the commission guidance on Where I've heard from the Budget Policy Advisory Group, we originally, at our last meeting in early May, we heard folks proposing kind of two camps. One, work really hard to secure the $30 million and maybe go for one or two strategic initiatives. Perhaps it's just around killer whale recovery. Another camp that we heard was, let's kind of ride the momentum of the proviso and the Budget Policy Advisory Group and the organization assessment and the zero-based budget analysis, which indicates we're not able to fully implement the department's mission. And let's have a conversation with the legislature about that need. And so this would be, you know, in the absence of the strategic plan, and we've talked about this before, about ideally we'd have gone through an effort where we did the strategic plan and then looked at our long-term funding and then submit a budget request. We're a little bit out of sync of that ideal way to roll out those policy conversations, but we're doing the best that we can. And I think that the strategic enhancements, when I walked through this on Wednesday with the Budget and Policy Advisory Group, there was a strong endorsement of this is the type of position that we should pursue. And again, we'll have an iterative process. If we change the amount of funding target, well, then what does that do for the relative ratio? If you drop a particular outcome, what does that do associated with the fee bill, et cetera? So I just wanted to pause here, Mr. Chair, and see if there was any questions or guidance there.
Recognizing the time limitations and all of the ongoing, that this is a work in progress.
Recognizing the time limitation, but I do not want to let this pass. I would like to make a motion for the reasons I stated before, give the commission a full opportunity to vote on this, but I would like to say that we can't invest $500,000 in a fish hatchery and then turn around and close it without too much negative effect in my mind. So I would like to move the OMAC fish hatchery alone from the list of the efficiencies to back to the list of the $30 million, where at least it stands a chance, and it could be closed later with any of the other fish hatcheries. So I so move to move the OMAC fish hatchery off the efficiency list and add it to the $30 million.
So there has been a motion put forward and a second discussion. Yes.
Thank you, Chairman. I'd be considering amending the motion to put more in there, just because there will be some perception sent and some signal sent if this motion passes that could be less optimal than maybe it might otherwise be. I wonder about the timing of this motion being voted on right now instead of August. There's a lot of questions in here and a lot of other things. I'd be inclined to support the motion, but I just wonder if there ought to be more than that in there, and whether or not we end up giving some policy direction to not go for 30, but to go for 33 or go for 50. I mean, when we get to some of these enhancement things, right. I'm thinking of even more than that. So I appreciate the signal you're trying to send, and I wonder if there's another way to send it without somebody saying, well, that was it. I guess that's over now, and the rest of that stuff might not be there. Some of my comments later are really going to be, in August, could you come back with more information? So there's a comment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jay, I'm sympathetic to what you did. I do feel that that's important. I think it's a timing issue. I think the timing's wrong to do it right now. I think we need to get a little deeper into this process and see what the big picture shows, and then step up and go forward. I just think it's singling out one piece of this right now, I don't think is appropriate.
I disagree. I think the reason we're having this review is,
as I've stated before, we oftentimes get this information too late to have an impact. I think this does send a signal early that we're looking at the budget and we are making recommendations of what we feel is inappropriate. Granted, there's going to be a lot more as we move through this process. And in August, I agree, Don, with you. But I'm going to support this motion because it sends a signal very early that we're paying attention to the budget, what the impacts of the budget recommendations are, And this is why we step forward at this time to send an early signal that we're paying attention.
Couple more.
Yeah. A question on the timing of it. If the vote on this was suspended until August, I think what we heard from the director was this hatchery would stay open through the next legislative process. So there's an opportunity for somebody to be a hero there and do some things. So I guess it's a question in my mind about sending a signal right now versus August, when maybe the signal might be a little different.
Yes.
Well, just to point out, we're going to be asked to adopt the budget
in August.
So right now, I think as Commissioner McIsaac has pointed out, that we really need to spend time on the guidance that we want to go forward. Are we going to say no, don't do any of these quote efficiency cuts? We want to go forward with a strong ask for $33 million for maintenance, and we support the enhancements. We really want the department to get going now on a $50 million ask. So I think, remember, we're going to be making a decision in August, and what's going to be presented to us, I think we need to get our position out now on what we're going to vote on in August.
Any other last commissioners want to say anything?
Yeah. I have no problem in August looking at other things as well. This good suggestion. I just think this really seems to be in the wrong place on what's been presented in terms of why that particular hatchery belongs in the efficiency cuts compared, you know, I'm not asking for the whole package right now, but I just think this one, and it's not saying at some point it wouldn't be considered to be closed. It just doesn't feel like it should be where it's at, so I'm not going to withdraw the motion if it doesn't pass, and in August we could discuss it some more. So,
okay, so the motion's been put on and seconded, and ready to take action on the motion. All those in favor of the motion, raise your hand. Okay. All those opposed to the motion, raise your hand. Okay. So 3-2, motion passes. Good work. Okay.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So we will move the reduction for the OMAC hatchery and move it into the at-risk column. Okay. Thanks. Okay.
And then just moving forward, we are...
Well, maybe just one comment on, if you're leaving this in August when we do get together, the question of exposing trade-offs. So in August, will we see something that would enable us to, this is an idea, maybe you can think about it, we can talk about it later, but the idea of identifying some, knowing the trade-offs. I mean, some of these hatchery cuts, for example, I might be willing to support if they happen to be planting hatchery fish in an area where there's a wild fish stock that's being impacted. I might not support any of them if I look at some of the economic pain here compared to something else that I've never seen. These all add up to 30. What's the trade-off? What are we comparing to? So in August, I would hope to see a little bit more of that. That's it.
Pardon?
Comment.
Oh, okay. Do you want to do your comment, and does that relate to that?
Yes.
Okay, then do that, and then.
The timing on this is impossible, and we are going to be asked to endorse and adopt a budget in a, what, hour or two in August. I think this is the wrong time to lose our workshops. I've been attending the BPAG meetings as often as I can, and I've watched hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours be put into coming up with this. There's all kinds of reasons for it. It's very different than the legislature's used to, and I think we need to understand it fully. So if I'm not going to make a motion. I'm going to make a suggestion that we either spend a good part of a day in August or a good part of a day before August going through this.
I think that makes sense, yeah. My concern about taking this line item right now, that was where I was voting on my...
As well on my side.
Yeah, I think that let's take that thought And we can discuss that in the upcoming conference call and plan a time that we can delve into this, because an hour and a half just doesn't, you know, that doesn't do it. And we can't go through this line by line. And, you know, we're not going to get through four lines in that time. So does that help you?
It does. And having some additional time explaining some of the trade-offs. I mean, some of the trade-offs that I shared with you were it's enforcement. It's the other 70 hatcheries that now not all those have flexible funding. So anyway, so we went through this, poured through this as an executive management team and with division managers to try to identify where those opportunities could reside within each of those outcomes. So I'm happy to walk through some of the other alternatives and choices that were on the table.
And what I meant, we won't take this up at the conference call. We'll do the scheduling.
Yes.
Right. Yep. So can we get back to 49?
All right, so I'm going to try to go through this pretty quickly for you guys. You heard about the budget items that are at play for next year. Now I'm going to run through the bills. We're looking at, these are still very much in development, so looking for your feedback. We're looking at phase two of our ADA statute revisions. Sorry, we had the first phase last legislative session, which was really focused on consolidating some of the rulemaking around ADA and broadening the signature authority.
Are we asking for money in that one?
There will probably be a fiscal impact. So what we want to do in phase two is broaden our definition of disabled. We've got a really pretty old definition on the books for the discounts that says we can only provide the discount to those in a wheelchair, those with a developmental disability, and those that are legally blind. This is out of alignment with federal ADA. It's discriminatory to provide a discount to one disability type and not all disability types, so we want to clean that up. There's some fiscal impact because it means more people will be eligible for the discount. So that's the big question. Nate and I are going to be meeting with the ADA Advisory Committee on Monday to get their feedback. We're also working with the sponsor of last year's bill to get his feedback as well. But some of the concepts we're thinking about, parks has a pretty broad definition, but also considers income. So that only those that are disabled and are low income qualify for the discount. So those are some of the things we're weighing as we look at drafting that bill.
I think this is a winner. I mean, I think this will pass.
Yeah, and
you know, I wouldn't want to be across the street being on the bad side of it.
Yeah. No, this will be a good one.
Yeah, so I think we should tie as many nice strings and ribbons onto this one as we can without being obnoxious.
Absolutely. Phase one passed with absolutely no resistance last year, so we're really excited about phase two. This is big. And then the second idea is moving forward with the hunting and fishing recruitment bill from last year. It was a great bill. It just got caught up in the large volume of bills that were moving last year. Again, as you'll recall, it gave us some authority to create bundled packages like family packages and multi-year license packages. It aligned the youth age to 16 for both hunting and fishing. It provided a $20 discount for those that made it through Hunter's Ed on their first hunting license. And then it also removed that requirement to have an annual license on the Lowland Lake opener. Good little bill. We want to move that forward.
Since this, again, these two hit the things that I'm really concerned and interested in. Just throwing this out, have you thought about hunting, fishing, and outdoor recreation recruitment or something? Tie this to health a little bit as well, because I think that would broaden the...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that's a great idea. We haven't built in much on the outdoor rec side on this one, but if you have ideas, we'd be...
And rec might not be the right word, but outdoor access, outdoor involvement, outdoor interaction, because, well, I have nothing opposed to hunting and fishing recruitment, which we absolutely need. By adding another word, you could bring in a whole different set of allies.
Yeah.
And as long as it's worded, that doesn't diminish the hunting and fishing recruitment. Put that up front, but... Those 2 cents worth. Kind of dovetails again, Nate, what we talked about last night and all this stuff.
I like it. We'll work on ways to build that in. We're also looking through Title 77 for any streamlining. So we've got a ton of annual reports that we are required to send to the legislature. So we want to try to get some feedback from the legislature on whether those are still relevant or if we're spending a lot of time on reports that they don't read. We're also taking a look at some of our restricted accounts to see whether the way we do it is the right way. A lot of them, like the warm water account and the biotoxin fee, they're stagnant fees. They're not a percentage. So we're looking at whether a movement to a percentage might be the best way to do that. So as fees go up, the percentages change in the accounts. So that's another idea. And then we've got the Columbia River Salmon and Steelhead endorsement, as Nate mentioned, is expiring next year. Really great program, funds most of our Columbia River fisheries. It's got an endorsement board that helps us figure out where funds are distributed. It's been a real great program. The legislature supports it. We just extended it in 2017, but only for 2 years. So we're hoping to get on the advisory board's agenda in the near future to get their feedback too on should we extend it for 2 more years, 4 more years, 6 more years, or take the sunset date out entirely. It's one that the legislature could just rely on an annual or biennial report from us, or could choose at any point really to terminate if they didn't think it was relevant, but they've been entirely supportive so far of the program.
Yeah, I would encourage you to go for remove the sunset date on this one, because if it comes up every year or every 2 years, it gets to be a political football. It's too valuable a program to be used as a tool like that. So,
good.
Mr. Chairman, this one, then the next one, can get into a lot of arguments about nickel and diming the public. And so I know we're short on time, so I'm just wondering if individual commissioners can provide some written options that maybe the staff can work with and we can hear more about in August.
Sure. Yeah, good suggestion.
That's fine. Yeah.
That's great, Commissioner McIsaac. We'd appreciate that. And now to what you've all been waiting for, the license fee concepts. We've been working with the Budget and Policy Advisory Group, as Nate mentioned, to start to look at some different options. They've spent a ton of hours really helping our staff spin the dials and look at, you know, the impacts of each potential option. And these are some of the things that seemed like the potential front runners. A modest across the board increase of about 12% to 15%. That would be well below inflation since our last fee increase. So hopefully it wouldn't be as big of a contributor to license fall off, but we're really concerned about that and watching that and trying to figure out how to ensure that we're not going to see a bunch of declines in license sales and participation. We're also super sensitive to the argument that we continue to hear about paying more for the same opportunity. So it's a tough one. We've also heard the idea of doing just a single charge or stamp, so like $10 on whatever license you're buying. That helps us with the hunting side, especially where a 12 to 15% increase is pretty significant. It would just treat all of our license holders the same, $10 for any of them. We've also heard the concept of inflation authority, so giving the commission authority to raise prices just based on inflation or just based on additional costs that come over from the legislature. State Parks has inflation authority. They use it to change their camping license fees, and this next session they're considering whether to use it on Discover Pass. We've heard the idea of changing some of our admin fees. So some of our licenses take a bit more time for licensing to process, so we could adjust some of those admin fees to be a bit more appropriate, so we're getting more revenue in so we can actually do the job better of processing them. We've also heard the idea of eliminating the 2 and 3 day licenses, so we'd encourage people to buy the annual license or multiple 1 day licenses and also pick up a bit more revenue through that. And then finally, the final idea we've heard is charging for a second catch record card. So for those folks that are catching more than 20 fish, they'd be asked to pay more for that additional card. Anything you want to add on that?
Quickly.
We need to rethink our out-of-state hunting license the way it's structured, because there's a lot of money to be had there. And in Washington, you go for all or nothing, where a lot of these other states, I've applied to about every other Western state, and you just pay $10 to go into a draw, and you know, it's worth the deal. With in Washington, you have to buy the full meal deal, and I mean, people just won't do it. So that's one where I think there's a whole lot of money to be had if we would rethink how we do that.
And I would encourage also what John said, all these comments like this, which are very valuable, that drop them a note, okay? So let's move.
Yes, please. Yeah. So just really quickly, as we've been considering these different options, we've also been considering the license data over time. This is hunting since 2007. You can see there was a pretty significant dip after 2011's 10% fee lift. So we're really sensitive to that drop-off and are watching it. It's a national trend also. On the fishing side, there was less of a decrease in 2011 when we had the fee increase, but we've had a pretty steady decline since 2015 in participation, and so we don't want to see that worsened if we go too high with a fee increase. So sensitive to that. Definitely welcome the commission's feedback on all of these different options.
So just moving to wrap up, Mr. Chair, throughout the late June, month of July, and early August, we'll start doing public outreach on these different concepts, bring that feedback back to you in August 10th and 11th. Sounds like there might be an additional workshop or a conference call or something that in effect where we can dive into more details about the budget packages as well as options. Ultimately, our long-term funding plan, our agency request legislation, our operating budget and capital budget proposals are all due to OFM in September. And then just on the horizon, we're thinking that with the new director going out and doing regional public meetings and really kicking off that strategic planning process for next biennium. So just a couple things that are coming down the horizon. Won't do any summary, and we've fielded a lot of questions, but that's all that we had presented for you this morning.
Thank you, guys. Excellent job, and very beneficial. And hats off to Commissioner Keeney for doing his job. Bringing home the bacon. Bringing home the fish. Pork. One note, too, when you said that people get upset about paying for more for paying more for the same, you know, not being a golfer, but the price of golf goes up each year, and the golf course doesn't change. The price of bowling goes up, and the bowling alley doesn't change, you know. And I think you could extrapolate that down a whole lot of different ways. So, I don't know. That's my frustration with that argument.
Yeah, I don't know who that is.
Hmm? Yeah, who is that? Oh, that's right.
Oh, sweet.
Is that she had the tonsils, right?
She's not going to have a great life.
Okay. Okie dokie.